Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast, the place to be for drama teachers, drama students, and theater educators everywhere. I'm Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. This is episode 159. You can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com, episode 159. All right. So I am delighted to say that this podcast is a conversation with playwright Stephen Gregg. If you're an educator, you know his play, This Is a Test. But you may not know about his long, long, long connection to drama education and theater educators. I'm going to link to his blog, Play Right Now, in the show notes. And I encourage you to go over there and read an article on his site that he wrote called Why I Love Theater Teachers. I am also going to link to Stephen's Twitter, which is filled with awesome tips for playwrights, student or otherwise. He talks about learning to write plays one tweet at a time, and it's something your students can do as well. So have your student writers go to Stephen's Twitter, pick a tweet, and use that as a reflection prompt. So here's an awesome one. Story is what happens. Plot is how the story is revealed. The Lion King and Hamlet have the same story, but different plots. Mm-hmm. So how would your students respond to that? How does it fit with their notion of story and plot? What are their examples? What examples could they come up with of story and plot? Ah, see? Love it. Okay, so what else does Stephen have to say? Let's get to it. All right, I am here talking to Stephen Gregg. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, how are you?
I am wonderful. And how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
That's good. Tell everybody where in the world you are.
I'm in Venice Beach, California, an area that's been, you know, appealingly funky for about 30 or 40 years and suddenly has become a little bit of a tech hub. So it's an area that's changing, but still an interesting place to live and work.
I like the phrase appealingly funky because because there are, you know, funky has its a range. You can go from, you know, because there's like those, it's hipster or a forced hipster funky and smelly funky and all those kinds of things. So I like appealingly funky as a descriptor. I like that.
Well, and 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, there were parts of Venice that were just dangerous that you couldn't spend the minute.
Isn't that funny how places, locations change? Because I live in the same, in a much smaller scale. And for our folks who are Venice Beach, is it outside? It's outside Los Angeles, yes?
It technically is Los Angeles. It's just one edge of it.
I live in the same kind of, in a much, much smaller scale, but the little village that I live in, its main source of income was closed in the 80s, and our big city used to literally ship their homeless and their and their low-income housing people to this place. So there was about 10-15 years where it was just like a desolate and crime-ridden, and you would never know that today. It is is a beautiful little haven, and it's just I just find it fascinating how we ebb and flow, you know.
Well, a lot of times it's arts that lead the way. You know, the artists move to the slightly ramshackle neighborhoods and fix them up. And that happens all over New York. And
it's because we can't afford to live in
that. Exactly.
How long have you lived in California and LA area?
I've been in California probably, it's 24 years. I remember driving out here listening to the results of the 92 election. So 25 years or so.
Does it feel like a blip?
It does. It surprises me that this is, at this point, by far the longest I've lived any place. But Los Angeles has a bad rap, but I think it's kind of a great city, actually.
I actually follow a number of people who live in different pockets of LA and describe it much differently than my stereotypical Hollywood vision of it. Uh-huh. You know, it's the kind of thing that neighborhoods, right? Like there's that there, sure. You think of LA as not having any neighborhoods, you know, where people walk their dogs and like children play.
Right. But there are.
Of course there are. Well, everywhere has them. How I want to start off with, so let's start off with your connection to theater. What's your first theater memory where theater was an important thing to you?
I think it was when I was about 6 or 7 and maybe not perfectly well adjusted at school. I remember my mom used to take me after school to, it was the Hayden School of Ballet. But after 4:30, it became a little theater school for kids who were actors. And Mr. Hayden gave us an hour of instruction, and then we'd tour to local libraries playing in these plays.
How long did you do that?
I would say probably 3 or 4 years until there were legitimate theater outlets in a slightly larger context before you had actual school plays.
And why do you think, so why was that, why is that the memory that holds on to you years later?
I think for me, adrenaline and memory are often linked, and you'd have these sort of scary moments when you stepped out onto stage and wanted to make sure that you did everything right. And I think that little jolt of mild anxiety helps really seal an experience into you.
I can see that totally. And did you ever want to be an actor?
At about that age, I did.
Okay, so what changed?
Well, I think the real thing that changed was that I was in a few plays in high school, but I didn't study any theater at all in college. And I did start, I tried to get into a sort of college theater summer program, I think after my junior year. And I realized that all of these kids, some of whom I had known for a long time and had been a better actor than they were at 9 and 15, suddenly they had all of this training that made this really not peers. There was really no reason I should have been auditioning because I was nowhere near the sort of technical facility that they had. And it was a good lesson in understanding that actors actually have lots of skills, that it's not just natural talent. I don't think I really realized that until late college.
That's really funny. So what did you study in college? Because I have almost the exact same experience in that I had a large connection to theater as a young person. High school, sort of, maybe one or two plays. I had a minor in drama from college, but I didn't go to college for theater in any way. What did you study in college? Like, what was your trajectory?
It was English literature.
Hi, me too.
Was it? Yeah, something that I had really gotten to love in high school and then continued on all the way through college. And I was also very interested in the sciences. So I was pre-med for a while. And I think, like a lot of people, the moment when you decide, am I really pre-med or not, is at least down here, it's organic chemistry. You know, it's are you going to take organic chemistry? Because the only thing you know is that you're going to be miserable. So there's just, you know, I don't think doing that crazy memorization. It just sounds awful. And that was sort of the decision point, which might have just been cowardice of like, I really don't want this to be my year, since I'm probably not going to go to med school. So I ended up being a microbiology minor. And that was a discipline that I happened to really like.
Okay. When did playwriting then come into the picture?
I had written a play actually, this is another science memory as I think about it. I had written a play, most of it, one night when I was supposed to be studying for a high school chemistry exam. And I really do think that some part of my brain was saying, chemistry is not really your future. You know, look elsewhere. And so I wrote a chunk of a play called Why Do We Laugh? And the next year, early in my senior year, I gave it to the new drama teacher, who's still there, Mickey Prokopiak. And he read it with a class of his without telling me. And I've just always remembered the conversation that we had when he came to tell me how much he liked it. You know, he was so enthusiastic. And so they produced it, and then they took it to the International Thespian Festival, which back then was in Muncie, Indiana. And that sort of hooked me.
That's awesome. So your relationship to thespians is long.
It is long, yeah.
And also, your relationship to drama educators is also long.
That's true as well.
You must have had to have really found some trust in your high school drama teacher to hand over your work. Do you think? Is that, what was your memory of it? Like, how did you know that it would be okay to give your work to your teacher?
Oh, I don't think trust was really an issue.
Oh, okay.
I was giving it to him privately. It seemed like the worst thing he would do is not read it, which certainly happens to writers all the time. So when all of a sudden he'd said, we read it and we liked it, it was pretty thrilling, I have to say. It was definitely one of the more vivid moments in my entire career, because it came out of nowhere. I didn't think of it as a submission. I just handed it to him.
And then what was it like to be a playwright and see it performed and hear an audience for the first time?
It was also quite fun. It happened a couple of times, and the same play, Why Do We Laugh, was produced a couple of different times at my high school. And so you could compare productions, which my family did all the time. You're like, well, that girl wasn't nearly as good. So it gave you a sense of the difference that a cast and a director can make. And it also gave you a sense of places where you relax because you know it's going to kind of play, and places where you get a little prick in the back of your neck because you just think, oh, I wish I'd rewritten this. And honestly, that was one of the lessons I learned the hardest, I think, is I really hate sitting in a theater and watching something that I don't really have confidence in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, because it's that work is your representative.
Of course, yeah.
So if it's something that I always hated workshop productions because, like, the performance part of a workshop production, because usually the work came in the workshop,
right,
and that I knew what I was going to go do, but then there was still this performance and you just sat at the back and went, okay, now at this point, maybe everyone could just cover their ears. That'd be great. And then,
sure,
and then we'll move on.
You try that, Lindsay.
Yeah. I'll just do that. I'll just stand up in the, okay, everyone in the audience, fingers in the ears. All right, you're good. I've never done that. That's So where did then, so you had this wonderful high school experience, didn't follow through with it in college. So when did you become a playwright?
Well, you know, what I did in college, it barely crossed my mind to try to major in theater, but I didn't. And I only took a very little bit of it, but I did the summer after my junior year, start a follow-up play. It was also a one act. And I knew that the structure of Why Do We Laugh had allowed me to cheat some things. It's four different couples, and so you can hop from couple to couple to couple. And I knew that in some ways I was using that to futz a little bit if I didn't have anything more to say, or if I ran out of how the scene was working. So I set out to write a full one act that was essentially just two characters. And that actually ended up taking me about 2 years. Just because I could tell I wasn't getting it right. And so I didn't really have anyone to give it to in college, because I didn't actually finish it until about a year after college. I just wanted to see if I could do this, the sort of perfect unities play. Perfect being modifying unities, not play. And so that also, it was received, it was published, but it was pretty clear relatively soon that people liked Why Do We Laugh Better? That's just something, I don't know if you've had this experience, but you kind of assume that your artistic arc is going to be vaguely, steadily upwards, but sometimes you really crash, you know?
Sometimes it's when that thing that just, some things are just better ideas than they are executions. They just are. And it's just like, that moment is always, I find, the most troubling is when you're in the middle of an execution and it's like, okay, well, we can go forward or we cannot.
And do you split the difference?
No, I go not. Sometimes I go not. I got drawers of things that, I think it's very helpful for me to work on more. I do quite often work on more than one thing at the same time.
Sure.
So it's never traumatic other than the loss of my time, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
I think there's actually more and more research that shows that the way you approach that is exactly right. That you don't want all your, the cliche, eggs in your basket. And that you really do learn so much by working on piece and piece and piece instead of trying to hold it all in one vessel, as it were. I think that's what I would advise young playwrights to do that I didn't really do, is to force yourself to finish, like it or not, and then keep moving on.
I think absolutely is the whole notion of finishing is crucial to making this more than an extracurricular activity.
Sure.
You know, like, and it's, and I don't know who said this. I think it was Seth Godin. Just that whole notion of shipping, like you have to ship, you have to get that stuff out there. And that we now I really can't imagine what it was like in the any time before the computer. You know, changes are always, I try not to, once it's out there, I really resist changing, but it is possible. Like, you know, it is, it's not like that it's things are as right. as set in blood and stone as they used to be.
True. I do have that same thought. Oh, excuse me.
No, yeah, go.
Well, just the idea that, for example, Shakespeare wrote these plays, and you realize he must have written them A to Z, essentially. Like, how do you do that?
Well, he borrowed. I think because there was a lot of borrowing and a lot of, I think there's a lot of collaboration too. Like, you know, because he had, those actors were there, mm-hmm. as I'm just imagining, and that everybody was working really quickly. I think he finished, didn't he? He was a complete finisher. Like, he was like, I'm here, we're in, we need to make money, and we're on. You know, like, it's, I'm sure it was way less romanticized than we think of it today, just because, and way less, you know, there's no dramaturg, there's no
right.
preview. There was just like on, and I don't know, maybe that's not a bad, maybe we overthink things sometimes, you know, like we get into a not a rotunda, a whirlpool.
Mm-hmm.
Where things get overthought. So let's talk about this is a test for a second. So mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was like it's like 28 years young.
Which Let I me think is it came out in January. It is 26. It came, no. Wait, it came out in January of 88, I think. 22. Oh, 28, actually. So This Is a Test was the third play that I wrote.
Ah, okay. And so what was the inspiration for that?
I was teaching in Brooklyn. I was teaching English and math because that's how much they needed teachers. I wasn't certified in either. It was tough times in New York City. And so really, if you just walked in and said that you had graduated, you could teach for up to a year. And I met one of the other English teachers who was delightful. And she had a background in theater, and she showed me a concentration exercise that I just loved, which is, and it shows up in the play. This is a rock, a what? If you've ever seen it, you know what it is.
Yeah.
And then one night, I was jogging I think I was in Washington, D.C. for a wedding. And essentially, this does not happen to me very often, essentially the whole play fell into my head. And I jogged for much, much longer and farther than I realized that I had. I got completely lost. At about midnight in DC, I realized that I essentially had the play, and I was able to write it in about 3 months, which is relatively quick for me. And instantly it was clear that people responded much, much better to it than they had to either of the first two plays. And one of the things that it took me years to figure out is that response was not necessarily a reflection of my own genius, but that in fact it had so many characters. This giant, flexible cast did not cross my mind that was the secret, but that was a big part of the secret.
Well, there's more than that, because plays don't hang around for 28 years unless they resonate. You know, there's a connection too, I think, because these characters, they do go through something that we've all been in the situation, right? We've all been there.
Of course. Yeah, that's right.
But do you think that is that the secret to this play? Is that, do you think it is the cast size, or what else do you think has its staying power?
I do think that's part of it, but I also think that for sure what you're talking about resonates with people. Test anxiety is something that everybody suffers from, and that chemistry test that I was avoiding by writing the first play, it was actually, high school was very stressful academically for me. It was a tough high school, and I was a good student, and that was a very hard combination, because you got a lot of C's. And I didn't think of myself as a C student, you know, but I was wrong. And then honestly, This Is a Test comes back and forth a little bit according to the political climate.
Really?
Well, during the, I'm blanking on it. What was the Bush era, largely loathed education mandate?
Is it No Child? No, that's Reagan. No Child Left Behind?
Well, I think it was No Child. I do.
Mm, okay.
Actually.
They're all loathed, aren't they? They're all, what are they all doing?
Why is the government interfering with your classroom, really? There was a lot of backlash, and the play spiked. And teachers would explicitly say, they have these awful mandatory tests that we're having to give kids, and that the play in some sense was palliative.
Hmm. Well, then we circle around quite nicely to the role of theater in an education setting. Mm-hmm. And you have had quite a close connection now
to educational theater. And did you ever see that for yourself when you were starting, when you started out, that that would be your...
Not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it didn't really exist 30 years ago.
Right.
You know, the idea that you're writing a play for high schools, I knew they were landing there, but it was mostly because the first one was written when I was that age. And so it took a fair amount of time, like 20 years, to figure out actually what I do is to write plays for high school students to perform. Because before that, you kind of like try to split the difference, you know, write a play that you could do in a high school, but an adult theater would do that. That just never worked.
Well, and there's all that when I was going up, it was amateur. Like, you would never write for schools because that wasn't being a playwright. It took me a good 15, 20 years to realize that making a living was making a living.
Of course.
and what was actually the most rewarding, and let's get right down to it, like, what is the most rewarding experience, you know? And I think educational theater kind of wins that.
It's huge. Sure.
Hands down. So you've determined that that was your bent. Did you just go forward with writing plays for schools and student performers? Did you leave adult world behind? Do you still have a finger in that? Or,
oh, I think it's good to have at least a finger, yeah, in another discipline. The more I realized that I was writing plays for secondary schools, the more I started to see the huge advantages that one had, and particularly in cast size. You don't write a play with a big cast because it'll hit the market. You write it with a big cast because there's so many things you can do with 20 people that an adult theater can't even dream of. They want seven or less.
Oh, and five, so, or less.
Right.
It's like, it's crazy. No. Well, and just like, just to see a stage full of people
is inherently theatrical.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a long way of saying that I do have one adult play that I chip away at. Adult play, there's got to be a better term.
I know. It's what I call them, but I'm like, there's connotations to this. This is not my intention. The other plays.
Yeah, exactly.
The others.
So it's two characters, which is the sweet spot theatrically for an adult play. And it's got some moderately serious tech because, you know, a theater can do that without having to pay actors, which is the real expense. And it's about really, really old people because I've determined that that's the prime subject for writing an adult play is you want to write I'm Not Rappaport, Driving Miss Daisy, or go on and on and on. But yeah, older people like to see themselves on stage.
Well, don't we all?
Exactly.
We all do.
Right,
there's lots of ways you can. We don't have to be murderers to connect. But no, I totally know what you mean. So as we wrap up here, let's end up with the importance of educational theater. Why, based on your journey in terms of coming from this is a test and your years of working with and talking to drama teachers, why do you think theater and education is important?
Well, it's a hard one to know where to start. But I recently wrote about an experience that I had seen watching a play of my own, which was that it was a play that had this enormous amount of exposition up top, and you had to have the exposition to understand anything else that happened in the play. It was a terrible play, but it was full length, and I was watching it with the theater teacher, and I knew something was off. And she said, "Oh, Portia had missed her entrance, and Portia was the character who had all of this information that she had to convey. And it was fascinating to watch the seven kids on stage have to handle that problem. How do we, as a team, solve a problem in front of 250 people who don't even know that there is a problem? And I thought it was kind of a great way to see what theater can bring to you. They had ensemble, and they had a lightness on their feet and a calmness in the face of minor crisis. It was really sort of a wonderful example of how this should work. And finally, after passing it around character to character, one of them said, "Ah, and look, here's Portia." Essentially, you know. So I do think you get a lot of hard to measure skills, as well as we hope a lot of empathy for the people that you play.
I think that's the frustrating thing for drama teachers know how many skills they are teaching and watching their students apply with being in a play. And it's so, you can't just put that on a test
right.
and hand it off. I had a discussion with a teacher once over one of my absolute, it's a frivolous thing, right? It's about mm-hmm. hair. It's frivolous. and how a teacher just went on and on about how she had a student who would not, who was distant, who was not participating, who was these things. And this stupid little play was uh-huh. the thing that made them come to life. And that's when I realized how important our job is
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't matter what the play is. It just doesn't matter. It's the experience of being in it and the community and that notion of ensemble you're talking about and the problem solving and all of that is what we are. We help. We have the tiny part. We have just, here's the play,
right.
you know, but I wouldn't trade that. My tiny part in that experience, I think, for the world. I wouldn't trade it for Broadway, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I say. But mm-hmm. I think that's where our world is pretty wonderful.
I agree. And I think you're adding the idea of encouragement, which is what theater teachers give all the time, and which isn't really something that you can get in the same way in any other discipline because the test still says 65. You know?
Yeah, it does. but you are wonderful for chatting with me for this brief time. And I know that among our listeners, you have a lot of fans, and I am thrilled to be able just to open up a little window and have this conversation with you. So one last thing. You mentioned that that finishing is a really good thing for young student playwrights to do.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to them when they say, "I don't know what to write about. I don't know where to look for ideas"?
Well, I'd say a couple things. First of all, get yourself some deadlines. Take classes. I still take playwriting classes. Join workshops. There's nothing like having a deadline to give you an idea. Because what you'll realize is you're no longer searching for the perfect idea. You're just searching for the idea that you can write before tomorrow. And that's very useful. I think it was Louis Armstrong who said, "I don't need time. I need deadlines." And I guess the other way that I do find really useful to work is that I'll take scripts that I like and I'll make an outline of them so that I really learn the structure of a script. And if you do that over and over, you'll get to a point where you kind of say, well, what if we took a right fork where that play takes a left fork? And then you think, well, what if we made the main character a guy instead of a girl? And what if we started it earlier? I honestly do think you can learn to write sort of the way the old masters learned to paint. You can copy beat by beat by beat, and eventually their discipline becomes your discipline.
I think that's awesome. And a great thing to end on. Okay, thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you so much. It was nice being with you.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Okay, before we go, let's do some theater folk news. Okay, so do you want some more resources for student playwrights? I know you do. All right, so I'm going to mention a couple. First of all, we have Scene Spurs, Writing Prompts for Dramatic Depth. So this is an ebook, and it is a collection of photo-based prompts, which gives students a jumping-off point for writing. Not only do you get the pictures, but there are instructions, questions, and scene monologue suggestions to get students writing now. Love picture prompts. They work really, really well. We also have a Playwriting Kickstart, an online course that will help your students come up with an idea, choose the most theatrical, and write the first scene of their play. Lastly, I want to mention one of our courses in our Drama Teacher Academy, the top 10 playwriting exercises. Not only do you get 10 great exercises to ease your students into the playwriting waters, it's also going to give you the confidence to teach playwriting to your students. And many of the modules include assignments and rubrics, so you will be fully prepared to comprehend, apply, and teach every one of these exercises. Okay, so all those resources, you can find links to them in the show notes. And where can you find the show notes? theaterfolk.com/episode159. Finally, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every second Tuesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk and on the Stitcher app. You can subscribe to TFP on iTunes. All you have to do is search for the word Theater Folk. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.